context, Caroline Casey. So, public service announcement again this week. Our allies are having an event on Saturday afternoon, March 23rd, 1 to 5 p.m. at the Starry Plow in Berkeley. The intention is to support artists in and from Gaza. So there we go. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. All stories lead us to all stories. We say, for as long as we've had cultural memory, human imagination has been tied to the sea and to all water, even to the extent, as Max Dashew, historian, tells us, that Christian monks in Northern Europe forbade women from gazing at water to induce reverie. We go, well, only a species that had forgotten its imaginative guiding mythos of collaborative kinship would poison the collective waters. So, by healing the waters, we heal human imagination, and vice versa. By healing human imagination, we can heal water. So, may cooperation eclipse domination. What water wants. We welcome Erica Geis to guide our rogue species back to collaborative Earth citizen manners, also known as animism, by asking, what does water want? Erica Geis is an award-winning independent journalist who writes about water, climate change, plants, and critters for Scientific American, The New York Times, Nature, The Atlantic, The Guardian, goes on and on and on, and we'll be presenting at Bioneers later this month. She has received the Rachel Carson Award for Excellence in Environmental Journalism, lectures at the University of Victoria Southam, and was a finalist for the Falling Walls Science Breakthrough of the Year. She's the author of Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. The book begins by asking a revolutionary question: what does water want? I was so heartened, just even in the introduction, going, oh, she's an animist and a pragmatic mystic. Most modern development has erased water's slow phases, wetlands, floodplains, high-altitude grasslands and forests that soften flood peaks, store water for droughts, and keep natural systems healthy. What water wants, say water detectives, exploring the question, is a kind of unengineering that reclaims these slow cycles, offering us greater resilience. Water Always Wins website is slowwater.world, and Erica Geis's website is Erica Geis, ericageis.com. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm so happy to be here.
Delighted. So just from the get-go, even in the introduction where you talk about the water detectives, and it's like, oh, that's right. And, you know, I'm outside Washington, D.C., and the River Tiber used to run under what is now the archives, right? And slaves were sold there. And then the U.S. Capitol has springs all over it, bubbling up. I don't know. Have you ever been there to see all the springs?
I've been to D.C. I haven't been there at times when the water was coming to the surface. But, you know, this is a phenomenon that's very common to cities all around the world. Many have paved over and put into pipes or buried underground or filled in wetlands, streams, and even rivers. And so, you know, my book is called Water Always Wins because sooner or later it does. And in these places where we've built on top of water, we often see the water returning to its place despite what we might have built there.
Yes. Right. So, right. In one of your chapters, you say the water joke is there are levees that have failed and levees that will fail, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, that is true.
Yeah. So the book, your dedication, is so connected to everything, right? Can we find allies in what we thought of as enemies? There's the beavers. We've done wonderful shows on beavers with Ben Goldfarb and Lila Phillip, you know, and the Phragmites, the grasses that grow.
Phragmites,
right? Well, maybe guide us into, you know, again, how what was perceived as an enemy coming into a collaborative better relationship. You know, well, with the Phragmites, that the very quality that made it a problem made it an asset, right, to the Marsh Arabs returning to their wetland.
Yeah, that's true. If I could just take a quick step back, I would say that a lot of my book, Water Always Wins, is really about the need for the dominant culture to change our relationship with water back toward what you've been talking about, you know, a more curious, more observant, more collaborative kind of relationship. Because in the dominant culture, we really tend to see water only through the lens of human need. And so it's either a commodity if we're worried about scarcity, or a threat if we're worried about flooding. And a lot of our ways of trying to manage water lead to kind of a single focus problem solving. So, you know, if you're worried about flooding, you build a levee. If you're worried about scarcity, you build a dam and you bring in water from somewhere else. But the problem with these solutions is that, in fact, they're helping to increase flooding and scarcity. So, you know, we're seeing a lot more really extreme floods and droughts all around the world increasingly often. And climate change is definitely a factor in that. And I don't want to minimize that. But another really significant factor that we don't hear nearly as much about is our land use choices that kind of focus on this single focus problem solving. So that also includes like urban sprawl, industrial agriculture and forestry, and ways in which we've just interfered with the water cycle on a really massive scale. And so if I could just give you a couple of statistics, humans have actually filled or drained up to 87% of the world's wetlands and dammed and diverted 2/3 of the world's big rivers. And the land area covered by pavement in our cities has doubled just since 1992. Forestry also is decreasing rainfall locally and regionally and globally. It's increasing the power of hurricanes and typhoons. We've really dried out the landscape by killing beavers, levying rivers, overgrazing, overpumping. And so cumulatively, you know, we're just not really allowing water space to do its thing, space to have its relationships with soil and rock and microbes and beavers and people. And one of the places I went where people don't have that approach, we think of that in the dominant culture as sort of like innately human. Of course, we're going to put humans first. But in fact, not all humans think that way. And one group that doesn't are the Madon, who are the marsh dwellers on the Mesopotamian marshes of Iraq. And their culture has continued for 9,000 years. And they live on top of the marshes. They build with Phragmites, as you mentioned, Phragmites australis, which is considered invasive in many places around the world, but it is native to the Mesopotamian marshes. It can grow to like 20 feet. It's an incredibly fast-growing renewable resource, and they use it for almost all of their building. And, you know, many very well-known irrigated civilizations have risen and fallen in this area over millennia. And yet, whenever they fall, the water retakes its marshes and the Madon continue their lifestyle on top of the wetlands. And so, you know, the longevity of this culture really pales in comparison to our own. And it's worth asking why. And I think the way that they relate to water has a lot to do with it.
That's really profound. And the beautiful pictures in the book of the Phragmites and the indigenous Marsh Arab culture that Saddam Hussein flooded, right? And you know,
well,
he drained
the wetlands, so he dried
that's,
them out.
Yeah, that's what I meant. That's what I meant. And I think just in the realm of water and metaphor, it would be good to eclipse compost, the draining the swamp metaphor. It's like, no, don't do that. Don't drain the swamp. Because what did you say about we've drained 87% of wetlands? Is that what you said?
Yes, that's right. And yeah, I mean, that's another example of how in our dominant culture, we are very control-oriented. Yes. We have this very control kind of mindset. And, you know, swamps are unwieldy places. And so that's in our lexicon, like the swamp as a negative. But in fact, swamp is one kind of wetland. There are many kinds of wetlands that are vary depending on the source of the water, the pH of the soil, the types of plants that grow there. And yeah, they perform such important services for us. They absorb floods naturally. They supply water throughout the year, so they help with scarcity. They store carbon dioxide, so they directly help with climate change. They are incredible repositories of biodiversity. And in fact, our attacks on these ecosystems have led to a really dramatic decline in the biodiversity of freshwater ecosystems. And, you know, I believe that other creatures and entities have a right to exist separate from what that they can do for people. But aside from that, these plants and animals also help these systems function. They are part of the system, and without them, the system is not healthy and cannot maintain itself. So they are really important for that reason as well.
Right. And then a tragic, wonderful book, Biofarewell, written decades ago about the Mississippi Delta, and it's gone, you know. And you do track, you know, again, how can things come back? How can we cooperate to bring things back? There's many, I'll let you go early, wherever you want to go. Yes, and complexity and cooperating. It's why everything in your book and your dedication is resonant with everything. Can we humans let go of control, right? So real power can come on in, and that mm-hmm. leads you to, you know, slow water and the theme of dams, and that dams mm-hmm. create inequality. That's such a good
right.
connection to make. Yeah. Feel free to say more about dams and the taking down of dams, and that the dams themselves create inequality about who can have water and who cannot.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, with our single focus problem-solving lens, we also create environmental justice issues. So I think people are probably familiar with the idea of levees as an environmental justice issue, because, you know, if you protect one community on the bank of the river, you're basically cutting the river off from its floodplain, and you're giving the water less space to be. And so that raises the flood level within the river and increases flood risk for other communities who maybe can't afford a levee. But dams are also an environmental justice issue. And there was this really interesting study that looked at globally over 40 years, found that dams brought water to 20% of the world's population, but decreased water availability to 24% of the world's population. So these types of interventions are really creating kind of water haves and have-nots. Among other issues. And, you know, dams are deadly for fish, particularly fish who migrate upstream to spawn, like salmon. And so the United States is currently starting to remove dams, and people may have heard of the Klamath Dam removals that are currently happening right now in Northern California. Four dams are coming out. And, you know, the Yurok tribe and other tribes in that area have been really a force in bringing this project to this point, because they've seen the salmon, who are so critical to their culture, completely collapse during the era of dams. A conservative House member in Idaho wants to take out the four lower Snake River dams. And it's because he's a fisherman and he loves fish. And after looking at the problem for 20 years, he has come to the conclusion that nothing will help the fish beyond taking out the dams. So in the United States, about 2,000 dams have been removed, which sounds like a lot, but the United States actually has about 95,000 dams. And, you know, a lot of those are small ones on private property. They're not all like the giant Hoover Dam kind of thing. But it's interesting that this is happening. And Europe is also starting to remove dams for similar reasons, like the dramatic impacts that they're having on ecosystems. But in the developing world, particularly in South America, in Southeast Asia, in parts of Africa, there's kind of a dam building boom underway. More than 3,000 dams are planned. And a lot of these dams are incentivized by our global lending groups like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. And, you know, there have been some efforts in those agencies to move away from dams, and they've moved back toward dams. So, you know, it's complicated, but it is interesting that in many places, dams are still kind of seen as this harbinger of prosperity, even though the true fact of it can be really, really different. Like in Cambodia, for example, there's a lot of dams that are planned on the Mekong River, which goes through six countries, starting in China and going out to Vietnam. And a lot of people in that area, like 60 million people, rely on the Mekong for subsistence fishing. That's their primary source of protein. And in Cambodia, they looked at, you know, well, how could we supply the fish? They recognized it was going to hurt the fish if they built all these dams. And they realized, like, even if they had fish farms, even if the government participated, it was just going to be too expensive and too hard to replace all that protein. And so a couple of years ago, Cambodia put a moratorium on dams that they themselves were going to build. Of course, they're still sort of affected by other countries like Laos, you know, building dams. And there has been some political changes there, and it remains to be seen whether that moratorium will last. But it's an acknowledgement of all of the impacts. And, you know, like cultural important sites can be flooded, like in Turkey, in eastern Turkey. Hasan Kiev is this, was a 10,000-year-old yeah. town with amazing architecture that was recently flooded by the Ilulissat Dam. I could go on and on about the impact of dams.
Right. No, it's good for us all to feel that. And because, you know, when we see the videos of the dams being taken down, I think the Klamath River Dam recently, it's like there's something in us that goes, oh, wonderful. And that is something, you know, again, throughout your book, delineating, we must look, as you say, you know, facing reality, but you do have this, we can do this quality, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you know, we can do this, yeah. and you point out many beautiful things. So, but it is important, yeah, to look at, you know, all of the all that's threatened, you know, the Amazon and the thing and and absolutely the, you know, the human nature, composting dominance into cooperation. Cooperators are standing by that idea of participatory, so crucial. And you know, again, wherever you want to go, I love you know, from Peru to maybe ending in China Camp Marsh, which is one of my favorites outside San Rafael, which is charming. But you know, you do say about Peru that the ancient could help the modern Peru adapt to climate change. You know, it's like we all want to go backwards in a sense. Our nearest exit may be behind us, kind of thing. if you want to say anything about, you know, Peru, you said that had canal irrigates in the northern Peru Zanya Valley back to 4700 BC, you say earlier than China or Mesoamerica, and that these ancient practices could help Peru adapt to climate change now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the whole book is really about people around the world who are innovating ways in which to collaborate with water. So it really is a very hopeful, solutions-oriented book, and it's portraying a global movement that's underway, which I have called the Slow Water Movement. And if I could just go over a few of the key points about slow water, which are, so it's a global movement. It goes by different names around the world. Sometimes in the United States, it's called low-impact design. People might have heard of sponge cities in China. Sometimes it's called natural infrastructure or green infrastructure. But I came to think of it as slow water because really what all of these projects have in common is restoring or protecting water slow phases, so wetlands, floodplains, water towers, forests, meadows, and finding ways to slow water on the land. And so I also coined this term thinking about the slow food movement, which, you know, slow food and slow water are each unique to each place. So whatever you do seeks to work with the local geology, biology, and culture rather than try to control it. So that means that slow water solutions around the world are all going to be a little bit different because they're in different places and working with different cultures. But there are some commonalities. And so these include respecting water's agency and relationships, systems thinking rather than single-focused problem solving. These are distributed solutions, distributed across the landscape rather than centralized like a dam. So that makes sense if you think of the 87% of wetlands that we've eradicated. You begin to understand why you need lots of places along water's path for water to slow. Slow water, like slow food, is ideally local, helping us to understand the local water cycle and availability and work within it. And that helps prevent the environmental justice issues that I was talking about earlier. And also, you know, the people who seem to benefit from these kind of traditional dam and levee interventions are also made more vulnerable. So, you know, that joke about the levees, ones that fail, ones that are going to fail. When you build a big, strong levee, people have this false sense of security and they build a bunch of new stuff behind it. And so it might not flood as often, but when it does, you have more at risk. And similarly, sociohydrologists have found that again and again and again all over the world, if your solution to water scarcity is bringing in more water from elsewhere, you're just going to perpetuate that cycle of scarcity. So it's just like when you build new lanes on the freeway and then you attract more traffic and you have gridlock again.
It's happening everywhere. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So slow water solutions are socially just and they're community facing. So in some places I went around the world, the community is actively managing these projects in a hands-on way. And in other places, maybe like the United States, you might still have the experts managing it, but because it's distributed across the landscape, it might be in parks or along river walkways. And so you have more people coming into contact with it. And so, you know, maybe there's an educational component like signage explaining what the land-water relationship is doing in that particular place. So, yeah, in some places, people are looking to earlier human practices. And Peru is one of them. And Peru is a country, it's got extreme water scarcity problems. And largely that's for two reasons. One, because of climate change, they have typically, well, 66% of the population lives on the very arid coastal plain. It's basically a desert. And they rely on water from the Andes Mountains, which are directly behind them. And historically, those mountains have had glaciers, which have supplied water throughout the year. But now with climate change, those glaciers are melting. And so they are worried about water scarcity during the dry season. And in Lima, the capital city of about 10 million people, they are already experiencing several hours a day without water. So the way that works is like if you live in an apartment building, maybe there's a cistern or something in your apartment building and the water, you know, comes in from the city and goes into that system. And then that's how you can get water around the clock, even though the city isn't developing it. So the water leaders in the country were very worried about this problem. And over a period of about 10 years, they passed a series of laws requiring water utilities to invest in natural infrastructure. So this was an explicit recognition that the natural landscape was a key supplier of the water and that it was the responsibility of the water users downstream to invest in the water suppliers upstream. So the people who live upstream are typically farmers, and they have communal systems of farming, and they have a that is still in use in at least three cities, something called the Munas, which is the Quechua word meaning to retain. And basically, they would divert water during the winter from heavy flowing streams into these natural infiltration basins, where the water would move underground and then filter. You know, water moves much more slowly underground than it does on the surface because it has to move through the rock and soil. And then it would emerge further down the mountain later in the year. So by doing this, they're extending the availability of water into the dry season. And this is a 1,400-year-old practice that was innovated by the Wari people. And the villagers who are still using it are descendants of those people. And the thing that really blew me away is that they have a mental picture of how water is moving underground, of the underground hydrogeology, because they understand from which amuna is going to increase the water in which spring. And then they have a communal system for sharing the water and for taking care of the system. You know, they have to clean sediment out of it every so often. They have ceremonies around it. And so this national law that is investing upstream, some of the work that they are investing in is repairing amunas in communities where they've fallen into disrepair, expanding amunas among communities who have maintained the system. And another thing that they're investing in is a ecosystem up there called Bofadales, which is cushion bog. It's a rare high altitude peatland. And it's, again, a natural way to slow water and really, really critical to biodiversity and the high Andes. And also something that the indigenous people there have managed for a long time. They have a technique for expanding the footprint of the Bofadales and allowing the water to move. There has been a problem with peat poaching. So, you know, if you go to a plant nursery, sometimes you buy peat for your potted plants. And in fact, you know, that's a very valuable resource in its place. It holds water throughout the year. It stores way more carbon dioxide than any other landscape and holds much, much more water. So I would encourage your listeners not to buy peat for any reason. So some of the projects also are going to protect the peat from thievery and also helping to restore it where it's been damaged.
And yes, and what does the peat want? It wants to be left in place, right?
That's
important. and again, just asking everything as you guide us and suggest. You know, what does the water want? Ooh. You know, mm-hmm. What does the peat want? It wants to be here. Everything's, you know, in place for a reason. Our wonderful guest, we're going to take a very short, appropriate music break. Our wonderful guest, Erica Geis, is the author of Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. Crucial, crucial. All stories guide us to all stories. This is essential reading, essential part of our understanding and our response. And we're going to have a very short musical break. It is Mami Wata. We remember that cultures all over, again, a reverent relationship to water and singing to water, honoring water. This is by a group called Sula Spirit. It's the vision, the imagination, and the water, and the music and poetry to bring our story alive. You know, and Erica is doing such a splendid job of this. And we'll get to living systems and many things and slow water and slow money and slow food. And we'll be right back after here is Mami Wata.
Mami wata, wele gona le mo, ipina chando ma. Ipigi wele gona le mo, mami wata, wele gona le mo, ipina chando ma. Ipigi, mother, grant me power to make wealth. Mami wata, grant me power to make wealth. Ipigi, mother, ipigi. Everything will be well when you say, Ipigi wele go na le mo. Mami wata, wele go na le mo.
Welcome back, allies. I hope everybody was undulating to that song, Mami Wata by Sulu Spirit, water, to protect water, become more like water, and the undulating. Our wonderful guest this hour is Erica Geis, author of Water Always Wins. And from everything, we know that, you know, when water is forced into straight cement channels, it cannot metabolize poison, but all the regenerative, you know, indigenous workers say, but when it has its curves, it can toss off poison again. We go, right. So the undulating. Do you undulate and dance to water songs, Erica?
Yes, particularly since writing this book, I've started to amass a group of water related songs, and I found one that was actually called Water Always Wins, and that one was about a guy's personal experience of a flood of his home, which was really interesting. And there's a jazz bassist in New York who has actually written an album called Slow Water, which was the working title of my book. And it was inspired by my book, and a lot of the songs kind of follow the chapters in my book. His name is Stefan Crump, and the album Slow Water is coming out in May.
Yes, I hoovered that from your Twitter file, going, oh yes, you inspired this. No, that's really wonderful, but you hadn't listened to it at that point, but now you have.
Well,
it's again the story, the narrative. I mean, you're in a great tradition of scientists with poetic kinship, indigenous hearts. You know, Lauren Isley. I mean, it's the wedding and the right relationship that you're bringing forward. And then just you know, in Peru, you write that the Nazca, had spiral paths that they drilled down to allow the water to surface. And cultures with spirals tend to have no evidence of weapons or fortification or war, but are, you know, harmonious. Spirals are nature's way of resolving conflict. But do you want to remind us of the ancient Nazca with their spiral pathways to, I guess, drilled into the earth to invite the water forth? Is that part of that? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I guess so. The Nazca were another civilization that lived in the deserts of Peru. The technique I was talking about before arose in the mountains of Peru. And basically, they were an agricultural society who figured out how to grow crops despite living in a desert. And one thing that they realized is that the rivers in their area were there. They were just underground. And so they built these puquios and ojos to be able to go down underground to access the water. But there was also a component of these holes into the earth that altered the atmospheric pressure to kind of keep the water moving into a place where they could harvest it. So yeah, it was a really, really innovative system. And in fact, some of them are still in existence today.
Right. And you do address like what must change. And at the end of the book, Water Always Wins, you do speak with other grown-ups saying, you know, people have to move away from the shore.
Yeah. So I think one thing that a lot of these different groups that I met had in common was, instead of thinking of water as a what, a thing, a commodity, or a threat, they think of it as a who, a relative, right, or a friend. And that kind of framing makes it much easier to see, you know, what water is getting up to think of water's relationships, to be curious about water, and then to try to make space for water to continue to conduct those relationships. And so, yeah, the majority of my book is focused on fresh water in various guises. But I grew up in the Bay Area. The vast majority of people on Earth live within 100 miles of a coast. So coastal issues are important, and particularly with climate change and sea level rise. And there is a very close connection between fresh water coming from the continent and the coastal areas. And you referred to one aspect earlier, which is the Mississippi River. And since the Mississippi River has been dammed and confined and dredged, it is no longer depositing its natural silt in the delta, which is part of why Louisiana has experienced so much land loss. And that is actually happening in other places around the world, where dams upstream are preventing that natural accumulation of sediment along the coast that is sort of in dynamic interplay with the waves, which sometimes bring their own sediment but can also take it away. And in San Francisco Bay, we are actually experiencing sediment scarcity. And that's partly because of all of these upstream dams. It's also because when we dredge for shipping within the bay, a lot of that material is dumped offshore in the ocean. And initially that was done because there was a lot of abusive dumping in the mid-20th century, you know, where people were dumping potentially polluted sediment and damaging ecosystems that way, or they were using it as an excuse to just fill in more of the bay so we could build more on top of it. But now, because there's a sediment scarcity in the bay, particularly when you think about sea level rise, people are working to kind of change those policies to try to make more use of the sediment that we do have from shipping, dredging for shipping, and then also, potentially taking out upstream dams or operating them differently to allow the sediment to flow through. And the reason that sediment is so important is because the tidal marshes that we have around the bay can actually keep up with sea level rise. They can grow vertically, but they need enough time, space, and sediment. Tidal marsh restoration has been underway in the Bay since the late 1970s. It's one of the oldest such projects in the United States. It's the second largest after the Everglades. And at one point, we were down to less than 10% of the Bay's natural marshlands and wetlands. Now we're back up to 25-ish percent because of these restoration projects, you know, like the Cargill salt ponds going away and being restored to the natural marshes and projects like that. And the people who are working on restoration are targeting, they have another 40% that's sort of in process, and their goal is 50% by 2030. So there's a lot of complexity to that. But yes, the sediment and the interplay of freshwater and sediment and tidal systems are all really critical.
Right. And then, you know, let's invite your take on how rapid the desirable response, how big the changes. I also, in hoovering your, I still call it Twitter account, you know, I saw that you retweeted a witty cartoon by Charlie Gardner, who says biodiversity loss and climate change are not information deficit problems and will not be solved by ever more precise data about where and how fast they're happening. And then it's a fortune teller talking to a guy saying, the spirits say you have all the data, just do something. It's pretty cute. So, you know, how big do you think the changes are that are necessary, and how do you see them? I mean, because I remember being like, oh, people should move away from the coast. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you imagine such a huge thing? Such a huge sensible thing?
I mean, people are already moving away from the coast. Sometimes, you know, when their house literally falls into the ocean, like we saw in Rodanthe, North Carolina, I think it was last year. And different places have different proposals for that. In my book, I write about England, which has a very long coast. And a lot of communities right near it. And basically, the Environment Agency there they've done a few projects like where they've restored.
Whoops. We might have lost Erica, but we will get her back. Might have restored. Okay. We are magnetizing the return of Erica. And her internet connection. And then just to honor, again, Erica is the author of Water Always Wins, which is a fabulous book. Again, one of those things like we got to know. It's part of it. Indigenous knowledge with science as happy partners. Participatory animism. She is a pragmatic mystic. And when she speaks about slow water and slow food, you know, and then I go to slow money. And it was years ago an economist said, you know, all of our metaphors for money are all water. And I said, oh, let's take this further. And he goes, yeah, well, pipelines go through inner city neighborhoods and suck water money out with outside ownership, you know, liquor stores, stadiums, whatever. And so then I go, so what we want to do is slow the water, slow the money down so it irrigates the neighborhood. And there was a study done decades ago about the circulation of a dollar in a wealthy community. It will circulate, I've forgotten exactly, like 14 times before it leaves. And in an inner city, you know, 40 cents, right? So slowing it down, so the slowing of the water. I mean, water and Erica's fantastic book, you know, Water Always Wins, you know, and thriving in an age of drought and deluge is so essential. It lends itself to metaphors. Oops, am I possibly hearing Erica breathing? No, I'm not. I'm imagining Erica breathing on the other end of the line. So let me just, all right, we'll see. All right, there we go. Okay. All right, we'll carry on. We'll carry on. And then I'll bring in the mythology. I didn't want to. Erica is so compelling. I wanted her to just go wherever she wanted to go. And may she return. That would be splendid. But as we convene right now, there is beauty and symmetry. Neptune, dreams, vision, imagination, water, the sea. The sea, music. You know, our imagination of reverent kinship. And Neptune is quintile, 72-degree angle, to Ceres Demeter, dwarf planet, goddess of the earth. A quintile is irresistible eloquence, right? And we say our ally Erica, you know, and her book, Water Always Wins, irresistible eloquence. And it's so useful to all of us because it's like, did you know about this terrible thing? And did you know about this really cool, beautiful thing that is going on in Kenya? Perhaps she will return to tell us these things, but I have notes. So did you know? So that's part of our being agents of cool response in a hot, reactive world. nobody minds being asked, did you know? And part of, you know, Erica's exploration and our, on this show, exploration of beavers, you know, we hosted Ben Goldfarb with his fabulous book, Eager, and Beaverland with Lila Phillips. That's really great. And Judith Schwartz, in her book, writes about how there was actually a government science information program in Nevada with ranchers who were used to shooting beaver and killing them. And as they got more educated, like, oh, you know, they could fireproof the land. How do we change our angle of relating that what we thought was an enemy is actually an ally if we change our manner of relating? And the ranchers themselves, I mean, they, you know, Republican guys, you know, said, well, why don't we sit in a circle? Why don't we sit in a circle? That the very thing, whatever we concentrate on, you know, we become more like it. You know, it's like, yes, spiraling, water, things, all of that, you know, cooperators are standing by. That's part of our exciting dynamic. You know, and in Erica's Twitter feed, you know, somebody said, you know, empires or ecosystems. And then we add, take your pick. Ah, she's back. She's back. Erica's back. Hello.
Hi.
Oh, how wonderful. So, yes, I was meandering on like a river, but saying, yeah, slow water, slow food, slow money. All of our metaphors for money are all water, currency, cash flow, liquidity. Yeah, slowing the whole thing down. But where you went away for a brief moment, you know, we were talking about what are desirable changes, what is your exhortational encouragement, you know, how big, what would you like to, if anything were possible, what would you like to see? Just a huge thing. And what do you think is the next move?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we are talking about coastal stuff. And basically, yeah, in England, they've said, you know, we're not going to keep protecting with hard defenses. So they've sort of given people notice that they're not going to continue in the future. And so it's up to people to decide whether or not they want to continue to take the risk of living in these places that might be inundated. And I talked to another person named Elizabeth English, who works in Louisiana and in Ontario with amphibious architecture. So the idea is that, you know, the buildings can kind of rise as the water rises. So, you know, that's an approach. In the United States, there was a study by the Union of Concerned Scientists that looked at, like, what would it cost to buy everybody out who lives along the coast? And I think it was, like, who is, like, going to be at risk of sea level rise by 2050 or 2100? And, you know, it was something like $1.3 trillion, which is a lot of money. But, you know, we did spend that much during the pandemic. So for rich countries like ours, that's definitely a possibility if we choose to prioritize that. And there's a researcher out of the University of Delaware called A.R. Siders, who's done a lot of work on, you know, managed retreat, which is what it's sometimes called. But, like, how can we move towards something better? How can we move toward more equitable communities? And I think you would ask me a question of, you know, like, how realistic is this? And there are a lot of aspects of the dominant culture which tend to be short-sighted, you know, quarterly profit motivated, selfish, that seem to run at counter to a lot of these solutions. But what I found is that it is a global movement. Many, many different groups of people all over the world are doing it. And sort of like you were alluding to with the Nevada ranchers and beavers, success begets success. So often, you know, the first person to try something, the first city, the first farmer, you know, people nearby might think it's crazy or it's something that they would never do. And then when they see that it actually works, and often at far less cost than the alternative, they start to rethink. And that kind of neighbor example is a very powerful force for change. And the really cool thing about slow water projects is that they can be very small. You can start small on whatever land you have, And just that one small thing can have an outsized impact if, you know, if it's done thoughtfully, and it can help reduce your community's risk from flood or drought. But then these projects are also cumulative. The more you do, the more space you give water for its slow phases, the bigger impact you can have in the way that solar panels on people's roofs ultimately add up to a lot of electricity. So, you know, I do feel like there are basic problems in our dominant economic model of, you know, this idea of perpetual growth, which is an illusion. The way that global crony capitalism is practiced, these things are fundamentally at odds with sustainability, which is enough for everyone, right? The goal is instead riches for the few. So, you know, there are key structural things that I think, you know, if changed, would allow these projects to be deployed more quickly. But the thing is, like, they are really, really effective and cost effective right now. And it is a spreading movement. There's a growing body of science that is showing that these projects work in all kinds of ways, that they offer multiple benefits, and that they're cost effective. So I do feel somewhat hopeful.
No, right. Well, we go, the situation's so dire we can't afford the luxury of realism. I mean, we can say that for a long time, backwards and forwards, you know, and experiment, cooperate. But I like imagining you with an arched eyebrow, just repeating your book's title, going, "You can build that condo right on the beach, but water always wins," right? You can do that. Erica arches her eyebrow, but water always wins, you know, and then just teasing it out. Yeah, teasing it out there. So it is, you know, it is experiment, cooperate in the whole realm that you're a part of, you know, all sane, reverent human beings are, you know, the biomimicry realm and, you know, Jeanine Benyus. And I mean, the solutions that you delineate also are so beautiful that it does speak to something in all of us. You know, and that idea of, for decades I've taken all the New York Times science articles on water as profoundly metaphoric, on every level, the high price of denying waters their wetlands, and I think it even in the title, I think it even said the high emotional price of denying rivers their wetlands, and it's like, whew, it's real, it's symbolic, you know, Right. So those things. So experiment, cooperate. I like when you say amphibious architecture that rises. I had a spontaneous like ooh, like a houseboat but better. You know, really, what you're calling for, what you're part of, you know, is, you know, a culture of reverent ingenuity, kind of rising, a renaissance, really now. Like, who brought what, you know? And it's like, as you delineate, there are many, many wonderful solutions, you know, and then you spent such a great time in Kenya at the Aberdave, is it Aberdave Refuge?
Aberdaris,
yeah. And maybe just a brief saying that, you know, because it's like, oh, where they're protecting it, and that creates a vision in our mind, like, oh, yes, that, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think the role of trees in the water cycle, the role of landscapes generally in the water cycle, is something that scientists are working in cross disciplines or kind of teasing out, and that is not getting hardly any attention in policy circles because I think people don't really understand it. But, you know, part of the reason that we're having more severe droughts is because of landscape desiccation. So killing beavers, clear-cutting forests, overgrazing grasslands, cutting off rivers from their floodplains and wetlands. And in all of these ways, you know, like 40% on average of rain comes from the exhalations of plants and soil, not from evaporation over the ocean. So it makes sense when you get rid of those, you're going to have less water. And similarly, there's, you know, we really have this kind of scarcity mindset in the dominant culture when it comes to places that are dry with water. You know, there isn't enough. We have to get more. We have to grab our share. But I reported on a story in Arizona where there had been deforestation, overgrazing, and when the monsoon came, the water would just tear through the land, through the creek, wash, you know, and be gone within a day or two. And these landowners started doing this indigenous technique of putting small rocks across the stream. And they did this, you know, in a lot of different places. And within a couple of seasons, the stream was running year-round. And it was because the water was flowing and therefore infiltrating underground and therefore able to supply the stream throughout the year. And, you know, the downstream landowners were like, oh, they're taking our water. But a scientist named Laura Norman from the USGS was really intrigued, and she spent a lot of time studying this in different ways. And one of the most fascinating things she found was that their treated stream was actually producing 28% more water. So it was an abundance result as opposed to the scarcity mindset. And it was because when you have water that's just moving really fast over bare rocks, a lot of it is just evaporating, you know, straight into the air. So
I love that.
Anyway, it's something that is really counterintuitive to the way that we typically talk about and think about water.
No, that's great. Thank you. I'm going to draw us to a close, but our wonderful guest ally is Erica Geis. Her book, which is invaluable, Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. We go, right, and saying reverent common sense, you know, let us all undulate more. Thank you, Erica Geis. Her website is ericageis.com and also slowwater.world. Thank you so much, Erica.
Thank you so much, Caroline, for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
That's great. And thanks always to Kirsten Thomas. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Thanks, team.